The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Saints, Miracles, and Witchcraft, is the last of a 16-part series from Yavne to Beitar. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the memory and Le'ilui Nishmos Arye Leib Ben Lippman, Mr. Louis Seiten, and Henna Bas Label, Mrs. Jenny Seiten, Aleha Masholem, of blessed memory.
Dag Hammarskjöld, former Secretary General of the United Nations, once remarked, "No choice is uninfluenced by the way the personality regards its destiny and the body its death. In the last analysis, it is our conception of death which decides our answers to all question that life puts to us. Hence, too, the necessity of preparing for it." In other words, in our own words, if you believe that your personality or conscience becomes irreversibly obliterated at the time of bodily death, you will tend to make certain conclusions regarding life. After all, according to that view, if you're a saint or a sinner, scholar or a boor, it ultimately makes no difference. It all ends up the same, death. In fact, according to this view, very often an unscrupulous and an immoral person can lead a fuller and more enjoyable life than his honest and decent counterpart. So, if your therapist has already liberated you from your feelings of guilt, or if you're from the lucky ones that don't need a therapist, why bother being moral? On the other hand, if there is life after death, it seems to imply that your essence is not merely protoplasm, but a neshama, a spirit. You simply occupy your body, like you occupy your house or car. At the time of death, you leave to another plane of existence. This world, then, is only one phase in perhaps an infinite existence. According to this view, it really makes a difference whether you're moral or immoral, whether you are a scholar or a boor, because how you live life here determines how you live life there. Despite the remarkably high level of education that most Jews receive, there exists an appalling ignorance throughout most of the Jewish community regarding the Jewish concept of an afterlife. It is truly amazing. As Mr. Hammarskjöld pointed out, virtually every decision in life is colored by our view of our fate after death. Yet there are millions of intelligent people, descendants of those that stood at Mount Sinai, who don't have the foggiest notion about this most important concept. What is the classical Jewish view about life after death? What really does happen at death? What's the Talmud's view regarding the world of the supernatural, the occult? Do ghosts really exist? The subject of life after death in the spirit world cannot be covered in one night alone, even if I do go overtime. In addition to Talmudic and Kabbalistic sources, there exists an enormous amount of evidence compiled by scientific researchers strongly supporting the thesis of an afterlife. In fact, this subject actually warrants a whole series unto itself. This evening, however, I'd like to discuss one aspect of the subject as it pertains to our ongoing theme of Jewish history. Over the last few years, we've covered people, events, and movements. We've witnessed the destruction of two temples, the repeated exile of the Jews, the emergence of major spiritual and communal leaders. Before we continue with this ongoing saga, I would like to take the time to explore from historical perspective the beliefs and attitudes the people held during this period regarding the afterlife and the spirit world. This is the subject of tonight's lecture. I hope every one of you has the outline that was handed. Very often, when you speak to Jews, outside of the Orthodox community, and we speak about the idea of an afterlife, the reply is very often, well, isn't that a Catholic view? The idea of an afterlife and heaven. Do Jews really believe in things like that? I would like to explore the original sources, at least from Talmudic and biblical sources, about the ancient Jewish attitude about life after death. What does happen? And I would like to start, here it says on the first page in paragraph A. It's also just reviewing biblical and Talmudic sources, it's just important to realize the framework that we're dealing with. The thrust of the Bible and the Tanakh and the Talmud is not to teach you about an afterlife or about the supernatural world. The Talmud is basically a legal and moral text. All that we're getting from, we're gleaning from there are, is basically in between the lines, so to speak. There are mystical texts. There are texts that date from the time of the Talmud. There are texts that date from the Middle Ages that deal extensively with the idea of the supernatural. The Talmud does not. But through the pages of the Talmud, we do see what their view of the afterlife is. As we began from the quote of Dag Hammarskjöld, that how we live life depends how we view death. That theme is echoed here in the first quote from the statement of Rekavya ben Mahalalel in the beginning of the third chapter in Pirkei Avos. He said, consider three things and you not come into the grip of sin. One of those three things is know before whom you will be judged. So before the king who reigns over kings, the Holy One blessed. Blessed is he. This ultimately after death, there's a judgment, which implies not only the idea of accountability, but the idea of the soul, the consciousness, surviving bodily death. In Koheles, this is the work often called, this is Ecclesiastes, toward in the last chapter, we've quoted two verses here in paragraph B. And the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns unto God who gave it. And the last was the last verse. For God shall bring every work into judgment concerning every hidden thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. In other words, A, we find the idea that the soul survives death, the spirit returns unto God. And second, the idea of accountability. What we do here matters. In the Jewish view, in the classic view of life after death, we are dealing with two time frames. One is what happens to the consciousness immediately after death, and the second is what happens to mankind after the end of history. The world of the spirit world, where the soul goes to right after bodily death, is sometimes called, if is best case scenario, is best, another called Gan Eden, not the physical Garden of Eden, but it's called this is, or in Kabbalistic terms, the Olam HaNeshamos, the world of souls. But that's the beginning of a process. We are told also of Olam Haba, which that term often is meant, at least the Rambam uses it, the world to come, referring to this world of souls right after death. But first and foremost, it refers to the spirit world that will occur at the end of history, at the end of the Messianic era, at the end of resurrection of the dead. And here you have this, the idea of Olam Haba, of again, the final spirit world. And this is referred to, as you notice, as is printed in the Siddurim, before every chapter in Pirkei Avos, there's a quote from the beginning of the 10th or 11th chapter in Sanhedrin, depending on there's two versions of the enumeration of the chapters, called Perek Chelik. And this is Kol Yisrael Yeshlam Chelik Lelam Haba, as we start. This is the heading in front of every section of Pirkei Avos. Every Jew has a portion in the world to come. That is the beginning of that chapter. There is actually, though, a qualification. And there are those who do not merit this world to come. Amongst those are those who deny its existence. It's only to those who are open to it, who have lived their life on that basis. And it continues on here as in paragraph C. He who maintains that resurrection is not a biblical doctrine, as it's a later doctrine, it's an invention, does not merit the world to come. Evidently, resurrection of the dead is the first stage, the beginning of the Olam Haba, those of this world to come. One denies it, one in this essence is denying this whole world, and one does not merit it. So besides the idea of, we've said about the survival of the soul, the idea of accountability, the idea of a spirit world at the end of all days, there is the concept of resurrection of the dead. Again, just briefly to explain what is the function of the resurrection of the dead. And this is really not this is really just an overview of, let's say, the classic Jewish view of the subject. We're not going into actually the details of the subject. There seems to be an argument between the Rambam and the Ramban and the whole Kabbalistic school. According to the Rambam, at the time of when Moshiach comes, there will be a resurrection of the dead. The purpose of this resurrection is, or at least the initial resurrection, is to give those people who did not lived in history, were denied the prosperity and the opportunities of the Messianic age. They will be resurrected. They will live in the Messianic age. And eventually, they will die. And their souls will be returned again to the spirit world. According to the Rambam, the eventual spirit world, the final one, like the first one, is in a disembodied state. In other words, the person does not have a body. This is just has his consciousness, just has his soul. That's the Rambam's opinion. According to the Ramban and the whole school of Kabbalah and of Jewish mystics, after the resurrection of the dead, there will be no death, so to speak. The body itself will change. As it will be like, in a sense, we have the sense of the story of Chanoch, according to the Medrash, that he himself, his whole body transformed to a spiritual entity. Or similar, or our view would be of Eliyahu HaNavi, in a sense, going up whole. There's a transformation of the body. In other words, there's a resurrection, person goes back into the body, and there's a change in the body itself to a spiritual. And a person will experience this Olam Habo in the world to come with this transformed body. So according to the Rambam, Tchias HaMesim is an opportunity to do more mitzvahs, to learn more Torah, to evolve spiritually. And given that opportunity to do so, according to the Ramban, Tchias HaMesim, the resurrection, is really the process of giving reward already. In other words, you've merited already before. This is just, now you're entering Olam Haba. So you're given the body transforms itself, and in that bodied state you become like an angel with the body. So Tchias HaMesim, the resurrection, according to the Ramban, is a reward, so to speak. And according to the Rambam, it's an opportunity. The reward, though, will be, according to the opinion of the Rambam, after the second death. Just by the way, and then we'll just, to give you the sense of this. According, again, the Rambam maintains it's an opportunity. Ramban maintains, you know, after the coming of the Messianic era, there's no Yetzer Hara. There's no evil inclination. There's no struggle. If there's no struggle, you can't put a person on earth to perfect himself when it's automatic. That's why, according to the Ramban, Tchias HaMesim, the resurrection, can't be a form of opportunity, because you can't get much opportunity if you don't have struggle. Because in this world, there's struggle. There's a Yetzer Hara. There's an evil inclination. You're pulled one way, you're pulled another way. You have to make decisions. According to the Ramban's view of the Messianic era, where there's no Yetzer Hara, where there's no evil inclination, you just do things automatically. So there's not much reward for what you'll be doing, because there's not much decision. Just like as normally a person does not, a person who's is well balanced, realizes, you know, what's good and what's bad, will not harm himself willfully. In other words, if a person doesn't have any desire for it, the person is not going to go and harm himself or herself. It's only because a person has a desire and one rationalizes destructive behavior. But if there is no rationalization, there's no, you see clearly, a person does normally, people don't jump off roofs into you realize, I mean, you have no desire and it's wrong and you won't do it. That's how the Ramban pictures what life will be in the Messianic era. So according to his view, the resurrection can't be for the purpose of opportunity, but rather it's for the purpose of reward. According to the Svarim, according to those who explain the idea of resurrection, there are actually, it seems, two periods of the resurrection. One is in the beginning of the Messianic era, and this is the opinion, this is, according to the Rambam's view, it's for opportunity, whatever. But there is an eventual, a second Tchias HaMesim, and that's the final judgment day. And all those who have lived from time immemorial will be resurrected to be finally judged. And this is, we have on page 2 in paragraph D, the quote from the book of Daniel, referring to this to this final resurrection, for some it will be this resurrection, this is some to everlasting life and some to shame and everlasting contempt. We finally, to conclude this section here on page 2 in paragraph E, with a quote of Rabbi Yaakov, who maintains that whenever the Torah speaks about reward, the whole idea of reward in the Torah, about some good days and long life, is really to be understood as an allusion to this Olam Haba, to this, the post-messianic era. And the blessings and the promises, even though they're couched, let's say, in very simple terms, long life, they are really an allusion to this, to the days that are eternally long, to the good that's without end. So in conclusion here, with this section, we see even the view of the few instances of Koheles and Daniel, that from the biblical standpoint, at least from these 4 minutes, it seems again that this is just a sampling. The view is that we, as you close your eyes, who are you? You know, that your consciousness, your personality, the you, is a spiritual entity. It will eventually go back to God at death. It will be judged. Eventually, and this is what we see from the book of Daniel and from the Talmud, that eventually there will be a Tchias HaMeisim. Those that have lived will come back to this earth. And the eventual reward, this Olam Haba, will occur after the period of Tchias HaMeisim, after the final resurrection. And we quoted the Rambam's opinion is that after the final judgment, everyone will die, basically, and again, their souls will go up to the spirit world. According to the Ramban and the whole school of Jewish mystics, of the Mekubalim, that the body itself will be transformed into a spiritual entity. And with the body, they will experience the world to come. I would now like to deal with another issue, a related issue. You're probably all familiar with the literature which has proliferated in the last 20 years about near-death experiences. And again, when we deal with the Talmud is not a mystical text. There's any references that we have are things which are brought in by the way. There are two incidents of near-death experiences which are brought in the Talmud. The reason they are brought is really for a moral lesson, but it's very instructive to see the literature person. This is on page 3. Reshua ben Levi had a son, Yosef, who became ill, became comatose. His father had assumed in that state that his soul had departed temporarily and had come back. And his father asked him, says, "What vision did you have?" And he replied, he claimed basically his soul had left and he had gone to the spirit world, viewed the spirit world, and came back. Just by the way, if we assume this, it's also assuming that there's a memory that we have which is not in our brains. Because if someone could have an experience outside of the body and remember it, there's no way that it was recorded in the brain. Perhaps there is the transference of memory from this other state into the brain. We're assuming the veracity of this. But it says that there is a memory outside of the brain, which has again, this is not, as we said, the topic itself really warrants a whole series. But at least it creates the framework of understanding of how it's possible, if one would assume, again, the veracity of this information, that people under hypnosis could remember past lives. How could you remember a past life in a body that doesn't experience? Where was it recorded? But if there is a memory bank, which is not in your brain, that perhaps transfers into the brain, but exists outside of the brain, in your neshama, and somewhere that there exists an independent memory, one could understand then that through hypnosis one could perhaps tap that memory, even though under normal circumstances one cannot. Again, getting back to the subject at hand, the person at least claimed that they had had a, what we call a near-death experience. And he said, what did you see in the other world? And he says, I saw a world upside down. Those who are considered prestigious in this world, the upper, have a very low place in this spirit world. And those who have a low place here are humble people. In other words, they're not really not given much honor, so have a very high place over there. He went on how, he says, what you saw was a real, well-regulated world. In other words, we only see the outside. But God sees what the true worth of a person is. What condition did you see us? And this is the scholars. So he says, as our esteem is here, so it is there. We could, and I'm just touching upon, you could finish the reading the end of the... There's another incident that's quoted in the Talmud about near-death experience. Rav Huna Breda Rav Yeshua, one of the great Amoraim, one of the great scholars of the Talmud, fell ill, also was comatose. Rav Popa, his colleague, felt that he was so close to death's door that he already had prepared the funeral arrangements were made, and the shrouds were being ordered. However, counter to their predictions, he survived. And he asked him, says, what did you see? Again, he assumed that that his soul had left. He says, they were ready to take me, but I heard that at least what his vision was, is I heard that God had told the angels, because he is a person who's Mavra al Midoisov, and he does not insist upon his rights. That is, he's a forgiving person. If he's a forgiving person, he's compassionate, he's a giving person, but we can give him also, and we'll give him extra life. And on that basis, he was returned back to this earth. Again, the Talmud only brings it because of the moral about the importance of being a giving person. It's not bringing it to teach us about near-death experiences, but we see that really was there an understanding that before death, unless these people hadn't died, but that the consciousness could leave before death and experience, says, the spirit world. There's a fascinating work about people, we just discussed about near-death experiences, and there's a vast literature. There's other literature, though, not as vast, but equally as intriguing, about people who actually did die. And there were interviews done to the nurses and doctors who were there with the patient as the patient died, or shortly before the patient died. The name of the book, the one that I saw, was What They Saw at the Hour of Death, which was a cross-cultural study between America and India about what people claim to have seen or how their mood changed or what happened to them right before they died. Much of what they claim to have seen is, we find parallels in either Talmudic or in the Kabbalistic literature. There is mention in the Talmud, though, of what we call deathbed visions, people who claim to have seen things before they died. The first on the bottom of page 3 is the vision of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. What is widely claimed by people, this is by those who were by the bedside of those who died, is that they see those who are dying, deceased relatives coming to them and escorting them to the next world. This is also in the Zohar. Several places also there's mention of the idea of the deceased relatives or friends, people who are coming to escort the one who's going to depart to the next world. Here on the bottom of page 3 we have a story of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai who claimed to have seen Chizkiyahu HaMelech. Chizkiyahu was the famous king. According to the Talmud, he had the potential actually of being Moshiach, but he didn't. He was a failed Messiah. He didn't. But he could have potentially reached that level and have brought in the Messianic era. Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai was dying in his last moments of life. He says he sees Chizkiyahu HaMelech prepare a seat for him. In other words, he came was to escort me to the other world. On page 4 we find when Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus, the chief disciple of Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, when he died, he was also in the Yerushalmi Seita, he also claimed to have seen a prestigious person of the past to come to escort him. And there's the two versions of what it had. Either it was Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, his Rebbe, who came now to escort his disciple, or it was again Chizkiyahu HaMelech. Remember this? It was the King Chizkiyahu. A theme again, which you find it in those who research, those who are dying, the deathbed visions, are people who claim they see the spirit world. They actually see it. They're half in, half out, so to speak. But at least that's their claim. In essence, those who've had these near-death experiences claim that they left their body and saw the divine presence. This is a theme which is mentioned several places in the Zohar. This is also is printed in the Talmud here. Maseches Kala, we also have, so before a person dies, he sees the actual vision of the Holy One, blessed be He. This person merits this. And it's interesting how this parallels to those who've had the near-death experiences about the being of light, who they identify in their mind, even though there was no identification made to them, but their sense was that they're seeing the divine presence. And it really is this is in Talmudic sources, is the idea that actually before the person has not died yet, but he is partially experiencing the world to come. We have in the last two quotes here on page 4, we find something which is unique. Was the idea of the gift of prophecy. Again, assuming a person is in an elevated state, a person sees the spirit world. In a situation where prophecy had come to an end, in other words, this is in the Talmudic times, and yet there are, at least on two occasions, we find whole prophecies, like a whole psychic experience, of people who are in the process of dying. One is Shmuel HaKotan, who prophesied the death of Shimon ben Gamliel and Shmuel Kohen Gadol, and what would happen by the Churban, destruction. And the other is when Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Yehuda the prince, the editor of the Mishnah, when he died, and this we have on paragraph E, a whole long what would be called a psychic experience describing events that occurred, you know, throughout in Bovel and about the death, about the birth of various people. We see that the prelude to death is not according to the Talmudic view. Is not, he says, that everything is shutting down, the organism is really dying and it's decaying, but really it's the release of new energy, and it's a whole new vision. It's a new beginning, so to speak. And that beginning is felt even before the death itself. The Talmud deals, and this is in the point here on page 5, have several citations about what happens, the presence of the deceased, his connection to her, connection to the world after death. Here we originally had the person gets a glimpse of the world to come, but that world to come, not everyone merits it immediately. As a person is given a glimpse of what's there, the tremendous love that God has for every individual. But a person afterwards goes, according to the Talmudic and to the Kabbalistic view, a period of judgment. According to the Zohar, actually, the soul during the 7 days when we sit Shiva, the soul is not at rest. It originally hovers over the body until burial. And after burial, the soul travels from the graveyard back to his home where they're sitting Shiva, and back to the grave, back again, as it knows no rest during the Shiva period. We have on page 5, Rav, the great scholar in the first generation Talmudic period, told Shmuel Bar Shilas, he says, Achim behespedo, be fervent in my funeral eulogy. In other words, you should give a good hespet. For I will be standing there. And this is the idea that by the Levaya, the Talmudic view, that the consciousness, the ruach of the person is there at the Levaya. In essence, they feel it, they see it. And this going to somebody's funeral, according to this view, is not just merely idea of paying homage. It's not just a symbolic gesture, but really it's an act of chesed. You're really doing kindness to the person. The person is there. And as we quoted the Zohar, and the person after the burial goes back home. This is just understanding the idea of why we have a light there, you know, symbolizing the neshama. This is the 7-day candle that's in the Beis Ovel. It's dissimilar that the soul is here. And here on paragraph B on page 5, Rabbi Yehuda said, if there are none to be comforted for a dead person, there's no one to sit Shiva. He has no relatives. 10 people go and sit in his place. This is the source, by the way, of why we have a minyan in the Beis Ovel. A certain man died in the neighborhood of Rabbi Yehuda. As there were none to be comforted, there were no avelim, Rabbi Yehuda assembled 10 men every day and sat in his place. After 7 days, he, the dead man, appeared to him in a dream. It was communicated. Said to him, thy mind be at rest, and maybe you'll be blessed. for thou hast set my mind at rest. Riabo said, this is, again, we discussed the idea of the person, the deceased, hovers over the body until burial. Riabo said, the dead man knows all that is said in his presence until the top stone closes the grave. You know, by the way, which is a fascinating, there are studies, there are published studies about when people are comatose, they're not dead, and they often recover, but they're in the, very often doctors seem to say as if the person is in a deep sleep and you can say whatever you want. Very often when these people come to, they have a perfect recall of all that was said. It's an amazing, again, I don't know if it's to be explained in this sense or maybe in a more physical sense. But, you know, it is important for people who are dealing with, you know, with patients that are comatose. Just be careful what you say. According to this, even when they're dead, you'll be careful what you say. On page 6, and just briefly touch upon this, you could read through the whole citation. So taken from a Gemara in Brachos Yudches Amud Beis in 18b. But it's how one of the Tanoim happened to be in a graveyard. You can read the details here on Rosh Hashanah. And he overheard two spirits speaking. According to the Talmud, until the decay of the body, until it's totally decomposed, there's very often the soul hovers over the body, just can't leave until it's totally decomposed. There were two people that were buried. One was buried normally, the other was buried in a matting of reeds. And according to the common interpretation is that it retarded decomposition. So here you have two deceased people. They're both hovering over. And they're talking. One says to the other, let's go to the spirit world. Evidently they could travel. And here, what is before Rosh Hashanah, this is on the day of Rosh Hashanah, what is decreed for the world? Like, let's hear what's new, you know? So they wanted to hear it firsthand. So they, so the one who was in this matting of reeds says, I can't go. I was bearing this matting. I'm stuck. He overheard the conversation. I mean, this is really, you should look at it yourself. And really the news that he picked up, he had insider's information and he acted on it and he made a killing. However, what's interesting to note is that the importance of the decomposition of the body and those who embalm or do it in a vault, which retards decomposition, may not be doing such a wonderful favor for the departed. Because it seems that the quicker that the decomposition occurs, that the soul is released. And one could then understand why tradition has it that one be buried in a simple casket that will quickly decompose. In a prison that's not in a vault, and this is earth that would create an environment that would hasten the decomposition. There's an extensive literature about mediumship, about communicating with the dead. It's something which is prohibited by the Torah. But nonetheless is a fascinating subject. There is a whole incident which is recorded in the book of Samuel, Shmuel Beis, This is in Enishmul Aleph. This is in the first book of Samuel. This is in chapter 28. When Shmuel Hanavi, this is on page 7, when Shmuel Hanavi, when Samuel the prophet had died, the Philistines were poised to attack the Jewish forces. Shaul was planning the next day to amass his army to counter the thrust of the Philistines. And he was scared, and he wanted to have some inkling of what was going to happen. Shmuel had died. He wanted, even though it's not allowed in Jewish law, maybe he felt that because of the necessity of the situation, he was allowed. He went to contact a medium. And he went to Ein Dor, where there was a woman who was a medium. And at length, it describes here, it's quoted on page 7 and 8, a conversation that Saul had with the deceased spirit of Shmuel Hanavi, of Samuel the prophet. Which again, we just see that from the viewpoint of Tanakh, of the Bible, that even though the thrust of Tanakh, as of the Bible, as well as the Talmud, is not to tell us about life after death. It's to tell us how to live life in a legal and moral way. But we see, that the viewpoint, we see in the background, that it was clear that they did believe in a life after death. And the consciousness does survive bodily death. Even though one cannot communicate with the dead through a medium, but there are other means. Less efficient, but there are other means. And this we have on page 8, in paragraph B. Rava was one of the foremost scholars in the Talmudic period. The Talmud quotes a fascinating incident here. It was in paragraph B on page 8. Rav Seorim, this is Rava's brother, saw he was at the deathbed of his brother. Rava was dying, and he saw him, and he was slipping into a state of unconsciousness. He was, he saw the Malach HaMavos, he saw the angel of death, Rava, and he turned to his brother Rav Seorim, and he told him, tell him, to take it easy, not to torment me. And Rav Seorim says, aren't you his intimate friend? Which is really, this is an allusion to that which is quoted in the Talmud on several occasions, that there were amongst the great scholars of the Talmud those who actually spoke to the spirit world. So he says, you're a friend of his. And he says, Rava said, since my mazel has been delivered to him, he takes no heed of me. Like basically, what have you done for me lately? So Rav Seorim said to his brother, says, show yourself to me in a dream. Tell me what it was like. Communicate back to me. So later on, Rava appeared to him in a dream. And he asked him, Rav Seorim asked his brother, this in his dream state, did you suffer pain? And he says, it was like the prick of the cupping instrument. And they used to let blood. This is like a shot. It was like this. So that's all. A similar incident happened further in this thing to Rav Nachman, who was Rava's Rebbe, his Rava's teacher. And at the end, it says that Rav Nachman appeared to Rava in a dream. This is on the bottom, page 8. And he asked him, how was it? And also, it was like taking hair from milk, he said. It just slipped off, like he just like easily left his body. But he said, he says, you know, I'd never go back to life again. He says, I was so scared that I would never live through, like, I wouldn't want to live through this again. Like, I've had it, you know. Again, this is just for your own reading. On page 9, there's another incident here of communication with the dead, which you can read on your own, but I'd like to see the page 10, which shows another aspect of the afterlife experience. Up until now, we've discussed three areas which there is considerable research: near-death experiences, and again, which we find parallels in the Talmud, deathbed visions, and mediumship, in other words, people communicating with the dead. There is a fourth area of much research, and that is those who claim to see apparitions, especially multiple. In other words, whole groups of people claiming to see apparitions, that the dead come back in a what would seem to be a physical state. As I said before, each subject really deserves a whole lecture in itself. I'm just touching upon it, which you find, you know, mentioned in passing in the Talmud. Yeah. Top of page 10, our rabbis taught. This is in the Braisa. When Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Rabbi Yehuda the prince, the editor of the Mishnah, was about to depart from this life, he said, "I require the presence of my sons." When his sons entered into his presence, he instructed them, "Take care that you show due respect to your mother." And the Gemara says that really, the question was his mother. It was a wife. It was a second marriage. The light shall continue to burn in its usual place. In other words, there should always be a licht. This is similar to the nair we have by, you know, the light, the candle we have for the deceased. And a table shall be laid in its usual place, and my bed shall be spread in its usual place. The bed referring here is not the bed that he sleeps, but like the hesabet, in other words, by the table. They used to not sit on chairs then, but they used to recline on couches or beds. What is the reason? He used to come home again at twilight every Sabbath eve. He used to come back. This is how it's recorded in the Talmud, that he used to come back every Shabbos, every Friday night. On a certain Sabbath eve, a neighbor came to the door speaking aloud. When his handmaid whispered, in other words, he came out, he says, "Be quiet, for Rebbe is sitting there." In other words, she gave out the secret. As soon as he heard this, he came no more, in order that no reflection be cast on the earlier saints that did not appear as an apparition. He's the only holy one, and they weren't holy. The Sefer Hasidim, this is written in the Middle Ages, Yehuda Chosid, brings another tradition that every Shabbos he would come to his home, he would appear in his precious clothing. This would be an apparition state. He would wear for Shabbos, fulfill the obligation of Kiddush on behalf of the assembled. In other words, he would make Kiddush every night for the family. He was unlike the other dead that are free from mitzvahs, because tzaddikim are still considered alive and can free others from their recitation from the obligation of Kiddush. Again, this is not very common. I don't know who's moitzi you in Kiddush, but it is at least, again, the viewpoint of those of the authors of the Talmud, this was at least a possibility. The whole idea that we say Kaddish, is really based on an incident which again we have in the bottom of page 10, which Rabbi Akiva saw an apparition. This is a story that he saw the apparition, who was in terrible torment because of his sins. The apparition, this person had left his wife who was pregnant. He came to the wife. I mean, he made sure the child, when he was born, had a proper circumcision. He taught the child, made sure that the child had an education. And finally, when the child led the services in the synagogue, the apparition appeared again to Rabbi Akiva and thanked him because of what once his son was davening, you know, for him, was davening, his soul already knew a rest. There's a question, there's different versions of this. One version has that the son said Baruch Hu and said Kaddish. And that really is the source where, again, the Middle Ages, the custom that the son leads the services and says Kaddish. And it's all based on this incident with an apparition. Again, you could look at it in your time. You know, you could take these home with you and look at the details of the story. There are other aspects of the supernatural. Up until now, we dealt with death. There's the other aspect of prophecy, that one is in communication with the spiritual world. When prophecy came to an end, the beginning of the Second Temple period, there was a minor form of prophecy called Bas Kol. It was a voice from heaven that was heard. The Ramban, one place, maintains that this type of a Bas Kol, this type of a voice from heaven, could only be heard by people who are fit to hear prophecy. In other words, you have to be in a very developed spiritual state to hear this voice. But there are various incidents which are recorded about the communication with the Bas Kol. Here on page 11, in paragraph A and B, it's interesting, the paragraph B, the story of Yochanan the high priest, that which seems to be the Yochanan who was the son of Shimon, the last surviving brother of the Maccabees. And he heard that when his sons went to war against the Syrians, that they had been successful, and he heard this voice coming out of the Holy of Holies. It's interesting that Josephus quotes the same incident and quotes that he was, Yochanan was a person worthy of prophecy, you know, and by virtue of his hearing this voice, and evidently had told people, you know, told them then on the spot what he had heard, and it was confirmed by, you know, by his sons coming back from war. Just in this last quote on page 11, we find the idea of ESP, the equivalent of to those who are naturally gifted, but rather as a sign of Ruach HaKodesh. It's because of their high spiritual level. And here's a story of Rabban Gamliel, who was able to know this person's name. As you said, you could look at it yourself in paragraph C. Just simply because evidently he had the psychic gift. There's a long literature through the ages, starting from Talmudic times, about Gilui Eliyahu, about seeing or communicating with Eliyahu HaNavi, with Elijah the prophet. And again, we have unquoted on page 12 various incidents that Eliyahu HaNavi, according to these are quotes not from people that are deranged, but these are our teachers, these are the authors of the Mishnah and the Talmud, who on many, many occasions, I've only just quoted two of these occasions, describe whole conversations with Eliyahu HaNavi. So again, in the view of the Talmud, that this was the contact, at least on this level of the spirit world, was very common. And again, there, one doesn't have the same degree of confidence. But at least purportedly, there are incidents that are reported throughout the ages of people who have contacted, who have spoken to Eliyahu HaNavi. On page 13, that we find like a wholly different kind of connection to the spirit world. You're all familiar with the story of the golem, you know, the Maral of Prague was supposed to have, according to the story, created this golem. It's based, at least from Talmudic sources, there's a Gemara in Sanhedrin, top page 13, Samachem at base. Rabba created a man and sent him to Rabbi Zera. Rabbi Zera spoke to him but received no answer. According to this golem story, by the way, Yosef Golem was not able to talk. He couldn't communicate. It continues on, Rabbi Hanina, Rabbi Oisha, through use of, the Sefer Yetzirah, that is to tap these cosmic forces, created a third-grown calf, like Erev Shabbos, and ate it. In other words, created from the whole cloth, but they created a whole, That's really one way to get around the high cost of meat, We're all familiar with the story as it's recorded in Sefer Melachim Aleph and Beis, of the Tchias HaMesim that Eliyahu HaNavi and Elisha HaNavi did on various occasions. There's a parallel incident that's recorded in the Gemara in Avodah Zorah in Yud Amud Beis in 10b. Rav Hanina Bar Chama, who through his prayer caused the resurrection of someone who had been killed. And Antoninus, this was the Roman emperor who was the friend of Rabbi Yehuda Hanasi, Yehuda the prince, said, this is the quote, "I am well aware that the least one among you can bring the dead to life." Really, this is the source where it's commonly that really the Tanoim and Amoroim had the ability to bring the dead to life. This is the source. And they were able to, through their prayer, to tap into this source. We're going now to the part that you probably all are waiting for. Just on page 14. The Talmud at length, at least this is the simple meaning, this is the understanding that the vast majority of commentators have in the Talmud, they take this literally. That there exists a parallel world and a parallel life form. And these are the Shadim. Time really does not allow to go into the various, again, I'll leave it to you, this is to read through on your own. About the Shadim. But I would like to quote just two things. On page 15, we see of a parallel life form. Not all those who are called Shadim or demons are bad. And amongst them we have called Yosef Shida, or Yosef the demon, who communicated with the Amoroim. There's a Gemara in Psochem, and this is quoted, this is on Kufiro Maralef in 110a, that describes conversations that Yosef Shida had with Rav Yosef, a different time with Rav Papa, and these are two of the greatest scholars of the Talmud. There's an incident related here in paragraph D on page 15 that there was a mysterious darshan, someone who lectured on Shabbos, same person. In the morning he was in Surah, in the evening and towards evening he was in Pumbedisa, two places which are very far apart. And this one person delivered a lecture in Talmud about to one group in the morning, one group in the afternoon. Who could have traveled so fast? One opinion, it was Eliyahu Hanavi, Elijah the prophet. The other one is this Yosef Shida, this Yosef the demon. And what's interesting is from the Talmud's view that it was a real thing. It was real, and this was a person who had tremendous knowledge that they could tap and appear to them in a, like an apparition would appear in a human form, the shade appeared to them in a human form. I would like to quote, this is not in your notes, but I would like to quote, and then we'll go on to the next thing, which is witchcraft. I'd like to quote from Josephus, a fascinating incident, which is in the seventh book of Antiquities, in the second chapter. Here he describes at length Shlomo HaMelech, King Solomon. God also enabled him to learn the skill which expels demons. This is quoted from Josephus, which is a science useful and sanative to man. He composed such incantations also by which distempers are alleviated. And he left behind him the manner of using exorcisms by which they drive away demons so they never return. And this method of cure is of great force unto this day. Now, there's, at least so far we see, at least the very least, that Josephus believed in the existence of, A, he believed in demons, and B, he believed in the possibility of exorcisms. Now he's bringing a real-life incident. For I have seen, this is his own testimony, I've seen a certain man of my own country whose name was Elazar, releasing people that were demonic in the presence of Vespasian and his sons and his captains and the whole multitude of his soldiers. Now, these were people, evidently, who, I mean, it's not clear, but it would seem that these people were troubled. Whatever sick ills or mental illness they had, they were troubled. And this Elazar came and cured them. The manner of the cure was this. And this, again, was put in the presence of, you know, the Roman general, of his captains, of a lot of people. He put a ring that had a root of one of those sorts mentioned by Solomon to the nostrils of the demoniac, in other words, the person who was suffering. After which he threw out the demon through his nostrils. When the man fell down immediately, he abjured him to return into him no more. In other words, he made this oath, making still mention of Solomon and reciting the incantations that he composed. And when Elazar would persuade and demonstrate to the spectators that he had such a power, he set a little way off a cup or basin full of water and commanded the demons as he went out of the man to overturn it, and thereby to let the spectators know that he had left the man. And when this was done, the skill and wisdom of Solomon was shown manifestly. This is the quote from, this is his, in other words, I wasn't there, I can't vouch for it. One thing is for sure, Josephus believed in it to the extent that he quotes the story. The idea here on page 15 of witchcraft is discussed at length in the Talmud. In fact, there are, it seems, two types of means of creating witchcraft. One is through demons. This is the Shadim. This is the last one. And the other are through, is we call Malache Chavola. In other words, there's another life form, another more spiritual life form, called the angels of destruction. In the story we have in the when Moshe comes and challenges the Parshas Vaera, challenges the sorcerers of Pharaoh, we have two terms, Latehem and Lahatehem. Latehem is referring to the Shadim, to the demons. Lahatelem, which are called Maisek Shafim, according to the Ramban and his commentary on Parshas Vaera, refers to these Malachi Chavola, these angels of destruction. But one could say, which is what really makes it fascinating, is we have basically an eyewitness report about the use of Kishuv. In a way which seems not to be, you know, just prestidigitation, in other words, just use the fast and the hand is faster than the eye, but rather something which is truly witchcraft. On the bottom, page 15, in paragraph B, Rabbi Eliezer, which is quoted previously, he was the chief disciple of Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai, before he died, was bemoaning the fact that so much of the Torah that he had studied was not given over to his disciples. And he gave one example. I have studied 300 laws, or others say 3,000 laws, about the planting of cucumbers by magic. We'll see what it is. And no man, excepting Akiva ben Yosef, ever questioned me thereon. For it once happened that he and I were walking together on a road when he said to me, My master, teach me about the planting of cucumbers. I made one statement and the whole field about us was filled with cucumbers. Then he said, Master, you've taught me how to plant them. Now teach me how to pluck them. I said something and all the cucumbers gathered in one place. That's a neat trick. But evidently, the Talmud actually asks, how is it possible for Rabbi Eliezer to use this because we are forbidden to practice sorcery? And it says, in teaching to teach the laws of sorcery, then one is allowed to exercise it just merely in teaching. Now, those who are teachers here probably could use this stuff too. Yeah. And again, since we have other quotations here on page 16. Another incidents were quoted in the Talmud. But again, I just picked a few of the incidents. There's much, much material. But not all that is unusual comes through witchcraft. And this comes to the final section here, which is miracles. You probably all want to know how to make miracles, right? The Talmud quotes various, again in passing, quotes various personages, various tzaddikim, who through their prayer were able to perform things which would go beyond the scope of the laws of nature. Three such people here. One is Nachman ben Gurion, who through his prayer, the sun stopped, or at least had the appearance of that the sun had stopped. We have the story of Choni HaMagel, which is, in fact, the story just in a brief form is quoted by Josephus as well, in the 14th book of Antiquities in the second chapter. There was here we have on page 18, again I'd like you to take this home and read it in your own time, where we find that Choni HaMagel, when there was a terrible drought, had drew a circle around him. He says he's not leaving until he sees results. And the rain fell. And he didn't like the rain fell. I want a little better, a little bit. You know, he was regulating it. You know, until he got to the right thing. This is what I want. But it, he was a person of such a reputation. Even Josephus quotes him. You know, quotes a story. But I would like to deal at length here with the last page here on page 19 of Hanina ben Doisa. Because not only do we have the the incident itself, but we have really the moral lesson as well. Because in the last page, on page 19, Yehuda said in the name of Rav, every day a heavenly voice is heard, declaring the whole world draws its sustenance because of the merit of Hanina, my son, who's a great tzaddik. According to this, the world survives on the fact that there are tzaddikim, that there are truly saintly people in this world. And because there are people who earn their keep, we, who don't, are sustained, by the way. Hanina, my son, suffices himself with a kav like a quart of carobs, from one Sabbath eve to another. In other words, he barely subsists. He barely lives. He is being treated midas hadin. In other words, God treats him. There's no favoritism. He just keeps him alive. But he earns his keep. Because he earns his keep, because he is a true tzaddik, the world survives. And it gives a intimate view into his life here. His wife would light the oven and throw twigs into it so not to be put to shame. Friday's a time of baking. Everyone's baking. In the old days, before gas and electric ovens, when you lit your oven, it made a lot of smoke. And people could tell outside if you're baking or not. She would go through the motion. Just put in twigs. People would give her something. She couldn't afford bread. She couldn't afford dough. She had a bad neighbor, who said, I know these people have nothing. What's the meaning of all this smoke? Who are they trying to fool? So she wanted to unmask these imposters. She went and knocked on the door. Rabbi Hanina felt humiliated at this, retired into a room. And then she just walked in. This is, hope none of you have neighbors like this. A miracle happened. The neighbor saw the oven filled with loaves of bread and the kneading trough full of dough. She called out to her, you, bring your shovel. You know, for your bread is getting charred. And she replied, I just went to fetch it. Atana, then there's another version, she'd actually had gone to fetch a shovel because she was accustomed to miracles. In other words, God takes care of her in a special way. Once his wife said to him, how long should we go on suffering so much? He replied, what shall we do? She says, pray that something be given to you, she replied. He prayed, and there emerged the figure of a hand reaching out to him, a leg of a golden table. Thereupon he saw in a dream that the pious ones would one day eat at a three, this is the vision he saw, at a three-legged gold tables, but he would eat at a two-legged table, meaning he'd eaten his portion of the world to come. Her husband said to her, are you content that everyone should eat a perfect table and we're imperfect table? So she replied, what should we do? Pray the leg should be taken away from you, she replied. He prayed, and it was taken away. In other words, whatever, if it doesn't mean literally, it means the blessing was showered upon him. Atana taught the later miracle is greater than the former, for there's a tradition that a thing may be given but once, it is never taken away. Once on a Friday evening, he noticed that his daughter was sad, and he said to her, my daughter, what are you sad? My oil got mixed up with my vinegar can, and I kindled it on the Shabbos candle. In other words, basically, there's just very little oil, and it's going to go out. All there is just vinegar here. I mean, it was just
in the thing of oil. So it just started burning, but it's just going to go out. My daughter, why should this trouble you? You commanded the oil to burn, command the vinegar to burn. And again, Atana taught the light you need to burn the whole day until they took of it for the light for Havdalah. Basically, what this is saying is, and you can keep on reading the other two incidents. That even though we are given a glimpse of a world that is very limited and works in a very confined manner, there exists outside of this world a whole other world that very often intrudes on this world. That's the idea of the miracle. In other words, that even though there's a certain sense to this world, but there are times for those that are worthy of this, that the laws of nature are abrogated and a whole new set of laws take over. I would just like to end where I began in the first section. We started off with the idea of the world to come and the idea of the final judgment. From the view of the Talmud, the important thing is not so much the fixation that there exists a spirit world or it's possible to communicate to spirits or demons may or may not exist, you know, or the existence of prophecy or the important thing is that we have to lead a Torah life. In other words, a moral, an ethical, a spiritual life. However, it says if the whole, all that there is what we see, and there is no more after this life, and when the body dies, the consciousness would come to a total and a final end, there's really no rhyme or reason to compel us to live such a life. I mean, why should we live a spiritual life if it really doesn't make a difference? And even if you believe that there is a God, God really doesn't care anyway, because it doesn't make a difference. There's no justice. So the whole framework of the Torah is predicated on the existence of a life after death in a spirit world and an accountability. But this is merely a backdrop, like a confirmation of where we should set our sights. But the thrust of our life is really to lead the good life. And that's why Jews, generally, even though they've always believed in this, rarely speak about this. Because what if you go to the walls and within the walls of a yeshiva, what they're talking or arguing or about are points of how to live life, or the points of certain of legal principles. This learning, even though it's important and occupies a very small part, you know, of the day of someone in yeshiva. Because the thrust of life is fine, you know, you can feel, at least from the Talmud's point, you can feel well assured there is a life after death. There is an accountability. There is God out there. But what am I supposed to do with my life? And that really is the essence of Judaism. Not to teach you so much what's going to happen afterwards, which is true, it's all part and parcel, but the thrust is, but what do you do now? And it's because of the thrust of the here and now, how do you perfect yourself here and now, that they're developed this erroneous idea that Jews don't believe in an afterlife, because all they're talking about is how to be a good person. But as we've shown through the various citations to this evening, that really the whole Jewish idea of leading a Torah life is predicated on the understanding of the existence of the spirit world. And 2 weeks from now, we'll continue on with this series, and we'll study the Bar Kokhba rebellion, which was really the final blow to the Jewish community in Palestine, and really was the final event in the process of the destruction of the temple and the Jewish community in Palestine. Now, are there any questions? Yes, Tom. So your question is, why can't we do this today? My sense, my first thing to blurt out is, what do you mean, we, white man? Yeah. Yeah. The things that you read about from the citations were not practiced by everyone out in the street. There were only, in other words, not everyone was a prophet, not everyone was a psychic, everyone heard this bas kol, so to speak. But there were individuals that did. There is a whole literature of people, of which is, seems the evidence is, I can't say it's a proof, but is very strong to support. There are people today who do have contact with the spirit world. And not in the Jewish sense, you know, but in this. There are people who have psychic ability. And there are people who have recall of past lives. And I wouldn't be surprised if there are not people alive for tzaddikim who do have psychic ability as well, from, you know, a different channel. The fact is that it's not widely known does not mean that it doesn't exist. Take, for instance, the idea of the near-death experience. Many of the people that were interviewed, and there are many, many books out and by people who are very serious researchers, were very reluctant to tell anybody of their experiences because everyone thinks that they thought they'd be crazy. So they didn't even bother telling. That doesn't mean that information is not necessarily out there, it's just not available. I can't say any more. Yeah, any other questions? Yeah, yes. The question here is there's a fascinating book, those who haven't read it, called Many Lives, Many Masters by Brian Weiss, who is the head of the Department of Psychiatry in Mount Sinai Hospital in Miami. He put under hypnosis a very troubled woman, which he names Catherine, who in the process relates to him these multiple lives that she has lived. And very often she describes that when they come back, this life, the people that she knows today have come back to in different forms in different lives. They say they come together as a mishpacha. Well, you know, mishpacha, she'll think about mishpacha a little differently now, you know. The Talmud does not speak about reincarnation, at least not in an obvious way. The Zohar, which is the ancient book of Jewish mysticism, speaks about it at length. There are, according to the Mekubalim, to the Jewish mystics, there are those who interpret Talmudic phrases in terms of reincarnation, but it's not. Basically, it's not all that obvious. From Kabbalistic sources, we do find parallels that people have to come back to be with the people that they lived life before to fix up. In other words, to right the wrongs and pay back the debts that were owed before. And very often one, you know, people do come back again in the same form. Not always. There's a fascinating work on reincarnation by Dr. Ian Stevenson. He wrote many works that are all fascinating. Dr. Ian Stevenson. One of the books that he wrote is 20, it's called, it's, there's 20 cases suggested of reincarnation. In other words, that the explanation of, put it, it strongly suggests that the only way to explain the phenomena is through reincarnation. Here he has a fascinating thing about your Indian tribes in northern Canada, in Alaska, where you find the reincarnation, you know, and they are born with markings on their, you know, on their body. It's a fascinating thing, which is suggestive, like how the person was killed in the last life. But they are born back into the same families. I don't know what to say, that birds of a feather flock together. I don't know exactly what the, but it does. There is in other forms of literature we do find similar, you know, and even Kabbalistic literature we find as well. Everyone goes through different paths. There are many, you know, many spokes, many strokes, and those different. There are many paths. Reincarnation is one of those paths. And there are those, it seems, that come back many, many times. Not everyone takes that path. There are those who just don't come back. They wander the earth. Reincarnation is really it's an opportunity which not everyone is afforded.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.